New York Times bestselling author Meg Wolitzer has always investigated the lives of women in her novels, but she's quick to point out this should be equally important to men.
Fiction is about reading about what it's like for other people. What is it like being someone else? And I hope that we want to learn about all kinds of people, regardless of who we are.
Meg Wolitzer and her novel, The Female Persuasion, explore old and new conceptions of feminism and motherhood brought to life by vivid characters. Begun years before the Me Too movement, this novel is prescient in many ways, as you'll discover in today's conversation with KCUR's Ann Kniggendorf for New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Meg Wolitzer was a guest speaker for UMKC's Cockafair Chair Annual Luncheon in May 2019, shortly after the paperback release of her novel, The Female Persuasion, from Riverhead Books. Earlier in the year, her 2003 book, The Wife, was celebrated as Glenn Close won the Golden Globe Award for Best Actress in the film adaptation of Wolitzer's sixth novel, one of three movies made from her work. The Female Persuasion has equally riveting characters, as you'll find out from novelist Meg Wolitzer. Here's our guest interviewer, Ann Kniggendorf.
You've said in other interviews and at the Cockafair luncheon that it's not only important to write about what you know, but to write what obsesses you. Feminism runs throughout all of your work, I think, right?
I would say so.
In this particular book, that looks like the lives of women and gender politics. Will you set it up for me? Will you tell me what The Female Persuasion is about?
Sure. The Female Persuasion is about a young woman named Greer Kadetsky who goes to college in 2006, and she goes to a frat party, and she's groped by a frat brother, and she doesn't know whether the thing that happened to her was an assault or was something she should just sort of suck up because that's what it's going to be like in the world being a woman. And when the famous feminist Faith Frank, who's sort of two steps down from Gloria Steinem, but was a very influential person in the 70s and is now kind of on the college lecture circuit in her 60s, comes to college to give a speech, Greer wants to go hear her and meet her and try to ask her, is there something to do about that feeling that I have about being female in the world? And the novel is really a look at female power, mentorship, misogyny, making meaning in the world. And I was very interested in that person you might meet who sees something in you and changes your life.
This is probably an unfair question, but how do you define feminism? Because it seems to be slightly different things to different people.
Yeah, I like that. It can mean different things to different people, but it's about, to me, the desire for and the need for equality. And I feel the different generations of feminists have different things that they want to be front and center. And second wave feminism has been criticized by younger women as being elitist and out of touch. And my character, Faith Frank, in fact, is criticized for those things. But I think that the media, to some degree, likes to make hay out of those differences. And certainly they are real and they are worth talking about and thinking about and working against. But there is a larger idea about equality that I think threads through all of it.
You've already mentioned Faith Frank a couple of times, and I really got to thinking of her as the matriarch of this novel. One of her strengths is the ability to get people to listen to things they don't necessarily want to hear. What message do you want people to hear in reading this particular book?
I don't think I would think of it in terms of messages, because if it was a message book, then it was a polemic and maybe not a novel. So I guess I would take out the word message and say I don't really know what I want people to take away, but I know that I'm trying to just explore what is it like for these characters in the world. I always sort of say to myself, what is it like? What is it like? Try to get to that.
Do you think more people are receptive to talking about or considering feminism again lately than they have in the past maybe 5 or 10 years?
Well, certainly the conversation has heightened with the Me Too movement in ways that I, you know, really couldn't have imagined. When I started writing this book 4 years ago now, or even more than that, but I would never have imagined that we would be at this moment where we are. It's a paradox, of course, because we're dealing with issues of misogyny in a way that we haven't seen. On the other hand, voices are being listened to in ways that hadn't been listened to for a while, too. So it's a very complicated moment, and it's hard to see where we are. On the other hand, the third hand, women have been flooding politics. We saw that, you know, through the midterms. So that's a very interesting and important aspect of what's going on.
Yeah, it's really exciting. Do you think that if you'd started this book more recently, that would have changed the way you framed it?
You know, it's interesting about the real world and its events in terms of a novel. I try to write fiction that isn't responding just to everything, because I feel like then it becomes as disposable as the news. Mm. My friend, the novelist Mary Gordon, said that the novel is the opposite of a tweet. And I think that's really true. A novel allows you the expansiveness and time to really explore the nuances of something. If I were writing it now, there would be more things that would be in my mind about what's happened in recent years. So I might choose to explore some of them. On the other hand, I might choose to ignore some of them, too, because I'm not trying to just write a replication of the news. That's why we have the news.
Well, I wondered if you would read a little from your book. This is a scene where the young Greer meets Faith Frank. Greer and her friend Z have just listened to Faith Frank, who is at this point supposed to be past her prime, right, but still working and doing good things. And Greer hopes to have a word with her. So the two friends follow the famous woman into the bathroom, if you wouldn't mind reading that.
Okay. Inside the warm ladies' room with its milky gray acoustically sensitive tile, only one stall was in use. Z and Greer took the ones on either side of it, trying to look like normal people availing themselves of a public bathroom. Greer sat down and dipped her head, seeing the edge of a woman's gray suede boot beneath the divider. She held very still and didn't make a sound. From the other side of the graffitied wall with a disturbing message scratched onto it in a very small hand, "Please, can anyone help me? I'd like to cut myself." There was a pause and then the predictable release. The single strand, the straight line from body opening to waiting water, the ordinariness of Faith Frank, famous feminist, peeing. The vulnerability and realness of women were on display right here, and Faith flushed and emerged. Greer stood. Through the space between door and frame, she watched Faith go over to the mirror. Z hadn't come out of her own stall yet. She was obviously waiting, kindly allowing Greer to approach first. But Greer noticed then that Faith was leaning on the sink for a moment, closing her eyes, and then Faith sighed. Greer knew that Faith was taking a second for herself, which she probably really needed. Tonight, everyone had wanted something from her, and it had all had a cumulative effect. No one was a bottomless well of giving, not even Faith Frank. Greer had been all set to burst forth and try to finish her conversation with Faith, but now she hesitated. She didn't want to add to Faith's burden, but she couldn't keep staying in here forever, so she unlatched the door and walked to the sink, smiling tentatively at Faith, attempting a state that would appear the opposite of demanding. Faith looked at Greer in the mirror and said, "Oh, hello. You were asking me a question in there, right? And then the evening was suddenly cut off. I'm sorry about that." Greer just looked at her. Faith was apologizing for not finishing her exchange with Greer, a stranger, in the chapel. How are you like this, Greer thought, she who could barely manage her own needs and to some extent Corey's. But it all came naturally to Faith. She had been doing this for a very long time. "That's so nice of you," Greer said. "It's just that when you told me to speak up in there, it was hard for me. Listen to that. My voice just goes up. I don't really know how to be," she admitted. Then she stopped talking. Faith considered her. "Tell me your name." "Greer Kadetsky." "All right, Greer. No one said there was one way to be. There isn't. But it would be nice to be able to say what I think, what I believe, without feeling like I'm about to have a stroke." "Well, that is certainly true. I had a teacher who used to tell the boys to use their inside voices. I'm thinking maybe I should use my outside voice." "Maybe. But don't be hard on yourself. Don't beat yourself up. Just try to accomplish what you can and see what you care about while being yourself."
You've just heard Meg Wolitzer read from her novel, The Female Persuasion. This is New Letters on the Air. I'm Ann Koenigendorf. I couldn't help but wonder if you find yourself playing out similar scenes in real life. Has this happened to you?
Actually, it was pretty funny because I was in Germany giving a reading, and these women followed me into the bathroom, and they said, "Look," in their German accents. Imagine in German, "We followed you into the bathroom to recreate the scene in your novel with Faye Frank." It was very funny. So that was the most extreme version of that. But I guess what you mean is, you know, do people want some advice? And sure.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they absolutely find you afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, in The Female Persuasion, you make a point of highlighting the ongoingness of the feminist discussion with nods to suffragettes like Faith Frank's very cool desk made from a suffragette door.
Yeah.
And Faith Frank's work in the 1960s and 70s. But then the younger protagonist, Greer Kadetsky, she's also interested in carrying that torch. And then right at the end, you have the babysitter that Greer hires talking about newer ideas around feminism and gender. Why does it seem that each generation has to pick this up and redefine it? I mean, that's just true for so many things, but why is it true for this particular topic?
I had a conversation with my editor about these questions, and she said, every generation grows up in a different time. So right there, they're not the same. They've had a different experience. The way women have been treated, the opportunities for women change, and they're growing up in a different world. So that when they come to their own political consciousness, they are doing so through their own experience as well as the history that preceded that. And I think because of that, it's not monolithic. And everybody, when they're starting out and thinking about activism, has a certain kind of fire and desire to do something. And I think that may be more similar among the generations and over the centuries even than the ways in which it's enacted. So I think that for women, that's really true. Looking at feminism, even now, we're in this early stage of something new. I don't know what it's going to feel like. I don't know where it's going. There's a lot of anxiety around it as well as excitement around this moment, but great fear too.
Also right there at the end, it comes up that racism needs to be spoken of in a similar way too, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think ideas around the ways that some generations can be blind to things that are important to later generations is something I wanted to get at here, that the feminism of this era had to be much more inclusive. That was something that Faith was criticized for.
And do you think that at any point this ends? Is there an end to this sort of conversation, or is it, will it continue?
Yeah. I don't see it. And I think that when I was growing up and was in a consciousness-raising group when I was 14, there was a sense, really, reading Ms. Magazine and seeing how my mother had been so affected by the women's movement. She's a writer. There was a sense of maybe everything would be solved by the time I grew up. And of course, that isn't true, and it's a child's view to think that that could be the case. You want to see milestones. It's not about being excited, but relieved about certain injustices going away. But maybe it's not about that. Maybe it's going to be something that you are always going to have to be part of and work toward and understand that it's still changing shape and will change shape after you're gone. And that's both depressing but also realistic in some ways. You want to see things that change the culture so that it's fair for women. You want to see that. You want to see inclusiveness happen, and you want to see whatever your mission is, you want to see some of that. And yet I do think it's ongoing.
You've already mentioned your mother, Helma Wolitzer, the novelist. You were just speaking about her at the Cock Affair luncheon.
Of course. And I will say that my mother, Helma Wolitzer, has published in New Letters in recent years. She's published a number of poems, I think starting in 2015 and something in 2016 and 2017. And I was very, very excited about that connection today.
So yeah, that's great. That.
Yeah, she's amazing.
And is poetry new to her?
Yeah, I mean, she's done some poetry over the years, but she's primarily known as a novelist. But she has intermittently written poetry, but really kind of had a sort of burst of wanting to write poetry in recent years. She's 89. So.
Mm-hmm. It's exciting.
Yeah, it's great.
So much in The Female Persuasion addresses what it is to love like a mother and to really mother those around you and how that has to do with the strength of women. I thought that was something really interesting. You know, you have the scene in the kitchen, which I would like you to read also, where Greer cuts herself and we see Faith mothering, and Greer considers, or the narrator considers, what that sort of strength is and how that, even if you're looking at that nurturing role that mothers play, sort of necessarily, but not necessarily, instinctively, how even that is a form of strength in feminism. So I just thought that was really interesting, if you wouldn't mind reading that part.
Okay, so this is the scene with Greer and Faith in the kitchen. And then her hand cutting onions with new, slightly reckless assurance slipped, and the blade of Faith Frank's knife slid deep into her thumb. Oh, shit, Greer cried, jumping back as though she could escape her own injury. They were all upon her, and distantly she heard Evelyn murmur, "Look at all that blood. Oh, I'm not good with blood." Everyone rushed around, but no one knew where anything was except for Faith, who calmly took charge, finding a very old yellowed tin first aid kit in the back of the drawer beside the refrigerator. "No one has ever left here thumbless," Faith assured Greer, who was so mortified and furious at herself for ruining the moment that her eyes streamed with real tears, not onion tears. "Really? What about Thumbless McGee?" asked Tad, and the comment was followed by silence, and Tad quickly saying, "Sorry, I make bad jokes when I'm nervous." Faith turned to them and calmly said, "Why don't you all go take your drinks into the next room? Greer will be absolutely fine. I will tend to her." "Are you sure?" asked Ifat, going into assistant mode. "Isn't there anything I can do?" "I've got it under control. Thank you, Ifat." Faith stood beside Greer over the deep stainless steel sink, where she ran a thudding flow of cold water down upon the bloody thumb and then dried it, keeping pressure on the wound, and then squirted on some antibacterial ointment and wrapped Greer's thumb in a swaddling of gauze and adhesive. The light touch of this powerful woman was profound. So, too, was her choice to use her power in this tender way. Maybe that's what we want from women, Greer thought as her thumb pulsed and percolated with blood. Maybe that's what we imagine it would be like to have a woman lead us. When women got into positions of power, they calibrated and recalibrated tenderness and strength, modulating and correcting. Power and love didn't often live side by side. If one came in, the other might go. Faith was saying, let's keep it like this for a while and see if it stops. Hold it up. Keep it above your heart. I don't think you'll need a stitch. I can't believe I cried like that. What's wrong with crying? I think it's underrated, said Faith. But right now I feel like a little girl whose mother is fixing her boo-boo. It's so embarrassing. Not for the mother. I remember doing that when my son was little. Faith pushed her hair back from her face and said, in my experience, the rewards don't necessarily come when you think they will with your kids, and sometimes they come very, very infrequently. Greer thought again of the Pee-wee soccer trophy up in the bedroom and the highly cooperative boy who had won it, now in his 30s and off somewhere else. So when do they come? Oh, let's see, said Faith. When they're happy, isn't that what everyone says? Or when they're asleep? Sometimes I was ashamed of how much I liked it when he was asleep. He was a good kid, but it was just so much work. And at least when he was asleep, I knew where he was and exactly what was happening with him. And what about now? Greer asked lightly. What's he like? Now? Now I don't know him all that much. His life is his life. He's a tax attorney, and he's very different from me. Not sure he needs me too much, and I never get to watch him sleep. I've decided that there should be a national holiday once a year when grown children have to let their parents tuck them in one more time. She was silent, and Greer didn't rush in to speak. Faith was revealing herself, opening up, becoming slightly more known. There was a glimmer of mutuality, and Greer didn't want to do anything to discourage it. They were standing together in silence by the sink, by the window that overlooked the dark yard, which was lit with a single floodlight, into which now pranced a deer as if on cue. It stopped in the cone of light, looking around. Ah, my occasional visitor, said Faith. The deer had one leg tipped up as though it had been making its way across the grass when suddenly it became lost in thought, maybe thinking about berries or leaves or about the curious figures of the older woman and the younger one who stood framed inside a small window. Faith moved slightly and the deer startled and dashed away.
You've just heard novelist Meg Wolitzer reading from The Female Persuasion. I'm Anke Niggendorf and this is New Letters on the Air. What makes Faith so deer-like? I mean, she seems very deer-like and not wanting to reveal herself and skittish when someone gets too close.
Well, I think it was interesting to write about a mentor from the protégé's point of view, because the protégé only sees the mentor as this idealized figure sometimes, not always, but in this case, she sees her in an idealized way. So in terms of getting to know Faith, we don't necessarily really know her until we get a section from Faith's point of view. So whenever she comes too close to be known, she might skitter away, not wanting to be known.
Well, immediately following this scene, Greer, who's a vegetarian, eats a steak Faith gives her. Why does she eat that steak?
She eats that steak because she doesn't want to call attention to herself for being the one who doesn't eat the steak, and she doesn't want to offend this person whose admiration she so needs and wants.
That seems pretty cut and dry.
Yeah.
And it feels like so much more than that, though. You know, she talks about the texture of the now unfamiliar meat in her mouth.
I had a little fun with that because I definitely did. I mean, look, I've had experiences that were not dissimilar to that, where you don't want to do something, but you have to do it, or you feel you have to do it because it's a social nicety and the person who's doing it for you, you feel you don't want to insult in some way. But it's about more than that. I think it's about not being real. You know, here's a chance to not just idealize a person, but to tell that person who you are and what your needs are. And she's not at that place yet where she can do that.
Well, it really reminded me of the earlier scene when Corey, Greer's high school boyfriend and later adult boyfriend, where he wants to do something for Greer. And so he overhears these boys rating her as a 6. And he steps in and defends her and says, no, she's a 9. And he gets shoved for it and ends up with a scar later on his face. That seemed very similar to the steak incident to me because, you know, this is something that Greer feels that she's doing out of love in a way. She wants to ingest all of Faith, but it's something that Faith will never know.
That's
she's
right.
Sacrificed, just like Corey decides to never tell Greer that he defended her that way and got the scar that way. Were those linked in your head at all?
Everything in a novel, to me, is linked in that one scene might reflect on another and bounce back to that earlier scene later. I don't know that I thought of these two scenes in particular as relating, but I see what you're saying. And I think that it is true that in a novel, and for me, I think I'm often interested in moments that are not ever brought up. And in that case, they are linked, and I probably did think of it this way, that you do something, and even though the reader knows about it, the person in question might never know about it. And that's interesting to me because I feel that's a reflection of what life is like. And often in a novel, there's the impulse on the part of the writer to have the moment where people discuss the thing that happened. But often in life, they never do. You think you're going to, and then time passes, and you never discuss that thing that seemed important at the time. And I think I've done that quite a bit in my work.
I think you have.
I didn't know that until this conversation, so thank you for that.
Well, no, but it also just seems through the book, Faith is really the one doing the mothering. Greer talks about being saved by books. She talks about being saved by Corey. I think she even thinks that Faith has saved her. And so, like, Greer is always receiving the nurturing. I don't really see her turning around and nurturing someone else, not even Corey. But the steak incident and the no, she's a nine, those both seem like silent parental acts in a way, mm-hmm. even if they're not necessarily nurturing. Faith just seems so matriarchal in every way.
Yeah. It's important to Greer to keep these roles sturdy and firm and not changeable. Of course, that isn't that way in life, but it's important to her as someone who was sort of poorly parented. I don't like to use parenting in that verb way, but as someone whose parents didn't really know how they should be, the idea of receiving this maternalism from Faith is exciting to her, and the idea of maybe giving it up because you've offended this person is too upsetting.
Well, speaking of the parents, you're letting the parents be very, very flawed also. But by being flawed, they're just complex, like real people. So they're very believable. But what made you decide to give the parents so many flaws in this? Was that a conscious decision, or did you just know that they had to be that way to make the story move?
You know, I don't think I have a plan when I start out. And as you create characters, they become enriched by your thinking about them. But it stood to reason that somebody who so wanted a mentor and so wanted guidance from this idealized older woman might have something in her that had led her toward that. And as I experimented with figuring that out, it made sense to me that she was looking for some aspects of Faith that she hadn't found in her own mother. And again, this isn't to say that people who seek out mentors are this way. I certainly am not trying to speak for all people at all. But for her, the desire for mentorship is complicated by a little bit of blindness toward what the relationship is and what her role is in it. So I wanted to develop a childhood in her where her parents were behaving in the ways that I described.
Well, and it's like all the parents seem to be behaving in that way. I mean, Faith yeah. behaves a certain way toward her son. We learn that she's fairly absent, don't we?
I don't think of her as negligent. It's a, you know, a different relationship. She's a single mother for a long time after her husband dies. And, I mean, she is best inspiring groups of people, and she knows that about herself. She's not the idealized mother, whatever that is anyway.
Yeah, I don't think you have one of those. I mean, Benedita, Corey's mother, seems like she may be the idealized mother. Yeah.
But she, you know, has a breakdown and is unable to function in the world and needs her son to be maternal toward her.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what an idealized mother would be, but I'm exploring, I think, rather than mothers in this book, our ideas and our conceptions of mothers, the mm-hmm. sort of transferential relationship that I think people have toward women, particularly older women. So there is definitely that, whether it's a negative or a positive transference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking of the kitchen scene when Corey and Greer are nine, and she says this is what it is to have a mother's love, and Corey figures that there will always be a woman who loves him that way.
That's right. That's right.
And then it's interesting that he breaks down right when that disappears.
Yeah, there is something to be said for that idea in this book. I definitely was interested in it without knowing I was interested in it. I mean, I thought I was writing about female power, but it really came down to female power, even as we start seeing it when we're very young, and the powerful figure might be a woman who is our mother.
And we might not realize that she's powerful.
That's right, because the culture mm-hmm. denigrates the domestic life of women. I wrote a novel called The 10-Year Nap that really was looking at women, work, and child raising. And one of the mandates for myself in this book was that none of these mothers in this book who stop working when their children are born, none of them over the course of the book works. So the judgment that the culture might have when you meet someone and, you know, what are you doing now? I'm staying home with my kids. The way men's eyes can glaze over, or sometimes women's. I wanted to explore that thing. Like, how do we judge other people when we don't have the trappings of success to rely on as a quick way to judge them? And that was an interesting thing to me to explore, why what happens in the home between mothers and children isn't powerful stuff. Why does it have to be, you know, the battle scenes always?
Well, I guess we have that same shorthand. You know, you think of the career and you think, okay, I can understand that if the stranger's telling me about the career.
Yeah.
But then we also have the same shorthand for the staying at home and being with a child. I had something like that happen that stuck with me, and it's been something that I would like to at some point explore also, which is similar of I left the Navy to stay with my children. And immediately, within a week, I had to change banks. So I was in a bank, and this woman looked at me as we were filling out the papers, and I was sitting with my children, and she said, "Well, you obviously don't work," and turned her nose up at me. So, you know, I think about that all the time, and I kept thinking about that while I read this book, too. Like, what was it about that that made me seem like a non-person?
Yeah, that's really interesting material.
Yeah, it's disturbing. I read that you felt slightly concerned about the title of this book with female in it. Do you talk about that?
I have written about the different ways that men and women writers have been treated. I wrote an essay in the New York Times Book Review called The Second Shelf that came out in 2012. And the notion of women's fiction, the idea of a book looking a certain way to sort of key certain readers to it and key certain readers away from it, the notion that a book might have big letters on the cover, which sort of says this is an event. And sometimes books by men historically have had those covers. And books by women have sometimes had what I've jokingly called little girl in a field of wheat covers. But I think in terms of the title, you know, this book does have giant letters on the cover, but the title also has female in it. And I hear from men readers quite a bit. I think the readers of fiction generally statistically skew much more female than male, I've been told. I haven't looked at any of the studies, but that is the case. There was apparently a sort of thought experiment conducted by Ian McEwan. He went around a park in London and tried to give books to people. And I think it was hard to get the men in this experience of his to take novels.
Hmm.
But I want it both ways. I want to write a book that feels like it includes the world in it. And I don't want people to be scared off by a female. That doesn't mean women's fiction. Fiction is about reading about what it's like for other people. What is it like being someone else? And I hope that we want to learn about all kinds of people, regardless of who we are.
Meg Wolitzer, the author of The Female Persuasion, released in paperback in 2019 from Riverhead Books, shortly before she spoke at UMKC's Cockafair Chair annual luncheon. To hear this interview by Ann Kniggendorf again, look for our free podcast or visit newletters.org, where you can also order the magazine issues featuring poetry by her mother, Hilma Wolitzer. A production of UMKC's New Letters magazine. Partial financial support comes from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency, and from listeners like you. Our Support New Letters button is in the top right corner of newletters.org. Today's show was produced with Amelia Romine, Anna Stokes, Evan Lohman, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.